You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, our guest, Robert Kaplan, is the author of Revenge of Geography, What the Map Tells Us About Coming Conflicts, as well as, I think, about 20 other books, chosen by Foreign Policy Magazine as among the world's top 100 global thinkers. He's the chief geopolitical analyst for Stratfor, a private intelligence firm. He's a non-resident senior fellow at the Center for the New American Security in Washington, D.C., and has been foreign correspondent for The Atlantic for over a quarter century. The man knows what he's talking about when it comes to geopolitics. And we read your article, Terrorism is Theater, Mr. Kaplan, and I thought it was pretty amazing just how terrorists essentially are using sophisticated media to get their message across and to win the war. They know they can't win a war, but they know they can get into your head. Can you explain that?
Yes. We live in a media age. Remember, between the end of the Franco-Prussian War and the beginning of World War I came the high watermark of the Industrial Revolution.
By the way, I love really smart people who go, remember, the Franco-Russian. Yeah, of course, naturally.
The Franco-Russian, the Franco-Prussian War was a war with few civilian casualties, conducted with great dignity over proper battlefields. But a few decades later came World War I and 10 million soldiers killed in the most brutal industrialized fashion. Why? Because between those wars came the culmination of the Industrial Revolution, and the Industrial Revolution therefore affected how war was fought. We live near the first culmination of the first stage of the media age. Media, information, electronic communications now will affect the way that war is fought. And what the ISIS fighters have done is use the mechanism of mass media, in this case, a video, a docudrama, to promote a message that will win adherence throughout the Muslim world, or at least they hope it will. They had the victim in an orange jumpsuit reminiscent of Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, whereby they're saying, we are a state and we hold, and we have enemy combatants too, and we have our own way of dealing with them. The victim was beheaded. They could have killed him in many other ways, but beheading is a particularly visual crime that can be shown in very dramatic form on a video. So if there was not going to be a video, there might not have been any reason to execute the victim in the way that they did. Mm-hmm. It was all about manipulating symbols one after the other. The executioner spoke in a British accent. Therefore, they're telling the world, simply because we obey no limits does not mean that we are not unsophisticated.
Mm. And he also used a very small knife, which I thought seemed so intimate and even worse.
Yes, that's how I put it. It made the execution particularly intimate. So this is how the media is now a new weapon of war in a new age of war.
But isn't, I personally didn't watch any of those videos out of respect for the families. And you know, when you put people in a jumpsuit and they're journalists and you cut their heads off with a knife, no matter what you say, you've already lost the war. In a way...
What do you mean you've already lost the war?
In other words, I think most of the civilized world and most...
But frankly, they're not appealing to the civilized world.
Well, but even most of the Muslim world, I would imagine, would think, well, you're not winning anything here. I guess this is sort of a blunt and coarse way of saying, we're here.
But who are they appealing to? That's the point. I mean, in terms of winning
young
adherence...
Recruits.
Yeah, exactly. And that for them, like, that's the point. The message isn't... The message isn't intended for the civilized world.
The docudrama was in part a recruiting film.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's part of what it was. It was also a way to say we are a formal state. We have enemy combatants. Mm-hmm. We have executions. We monopolize the use of force in a given area. We can speak perfect English as well as Arabic. Are you ready to take us on? in other words.
But do you think that since now the whole world can watch these kinds of things, do you think that ultimately that might be a good thing as opposed to a bad thing?
I think it will be a value-neutral thing. I've seen no evidence that the fact that the world can watch reduces the horrors of war. People become voyeurs. The same reason for decades now, we've had the most horrific desensitizing video films, video games. And that has not reduced the penchant for violence, simply because people can watch horrible things. One could argue that it may even have dulled the senses and increased the propensity of it.
But
My point is that the nature of war is undergoing a shift, a transformation.
Right. Right, but doesn't it force the perpetrator of whatever said violence to at least have to justify it along, you know, moral grounds? And
from their point of view, they are, because they're saying that you invaded holy Muslim territory, Mesopotamia.
Which at least throws it out there for all of us then to debate whether or not they are right or wrong.
Right. Remember, what originally motivated Osama bin Laden was that the Holy Land, the country that hosted the holy places, that is Saudi Arabia, had defiled itself by welcoming infidel troops, American forces, during the build-up to the first Gulf War.
Right, right. To kill Muslims, yeah, using it as a staging ground to kill
Muslims. Right, yes.
That's right. That's right. It's how do we fight an enemy like this?
It's interesting. The United States has faced similar situations in the past. At the end of World War II, when it was clear that Stalin and the Soviet Union were not going to continue as our allies, but were in fact going to become an existential ideological threat and geopolitical adversary, we also lacked the tools for an all-out defeat of the Soviet Union, so we opted for a policy of containment, of vigilance, of allies, of information war, of a whole bunch of things to contain the Soviet Union so that at a certain point it would collapse because of its own internal contradictions.
Mm-hmm.
I think without using, though policymakers will never use the word, I think that is the policy that is going to ultimately result in terms of taking on, Islamic jihadists. It will start in the Obama administration. It will continue under the next president of whatever party. There will be arguments and debates among policy experts in Washington and New York over being how aggressive we should be. But ultimately, it will not be total war. It will be some form of limited containment that will have the following attributes: buttressing allies like Jordan, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and also bad illiberal regimes that we do not like the ones in Iran and in Syria. Because just as Franklin Roosevelt made an alliance with the mass murderer Joseph Stalin to defeat Hitler, we will make informal, undeclared alliances with nasty regimes because we face an even worse enemy.
Well, because also, hopefully we learned from Iraq. When I look at the architects of the Iraq War, let's talk about Douglas Feith and Paul Wolfowitz and Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, but primarily the intellectual force behind it were people like Richard Perle, etc., from what I understand. I hope that we've learned a lesson and realize that when you go into a country, no matter what your idea of bringing democracy to that country, I hope we've learned a lesson that, man, can things go wrong, and they always will go wrong, and look at the mess they created.
Yes. The United States can do a lot of things well. It can conduct naval warfare. It can support and balance in favor of allies like Japan and the Philippines against China. It can support alliances. It can have a Navy and Air Force that projects power over vast reaches of the earth on a daily basis. But managing and reinventing complex Islamic societies on the ground yeah. is not in our toolbox.
No.
And in fact, it goes beyond this. The United States is a global power. It has to, you know, maintain a balance of power in Eurasia, in South America, in the Far East, etc. But that does not mean it has the wherewithal and the ability to sustain a policy of getting involved, getting entrenched on the ground in any given place.
There is something else that I wanted to say as well, is that, and also, even if we did have the ability to remake complex Islamic societies, you know, invasion would be the worst tool with which to do it, because terrorism is theater. And so therefore, when you invade, you're giving them all of the things that they need to create a narrative about, you know, evil Americans.
That's true. That's very true. Keep in mind, we took two absolutely brutal fascist regimes that had wide popular support in Germany and Japan, and we remade successfully their societies on the ground. But that's because the American public supported it at the time. We had just fought a world war to change those societies, and now we faced an existential global threat in world communism. So there was public support for long-term military occupations of Germany and Japan. That does not exist today for any country in the world.
And not only that, I mean, I think the other important point is that the way that we did that in Germany and Japan was by providing peace and security for the population, which was the point that was made in the counterinsurgency manual that came out in 2007.
Right, absolutely true. And the reason we were able to provide peace and security was because we absolutely decimated the regimes there. And there was no other force there was nobody to challenge us.
Because
we had destroyed those societies right down to the ground.
We also, de-bathification in Iraq, for example, going in there and firing 500,000 people overnight. Thank you, Mr. Bremer.
Well, keep in mind, though, that de-bathification at the upper levels had to be done, if only to keep the Shiites on our side in the early phases of the Iraq War. Remember, we denazified, but only down to the top three or four levels. We kept the bottom levels to run Germany. Mm. What we did in Iraq was we de-bathified completely rather than just to the top levels. That was the difference.
Do you know why we did that, why we made such a huge mistake?
I do not know. I honestly don't know why we eliminated even people at the ground level who were required to run the ministries and all. I do not know.
Are you surprised by just what has happened to Iraq? Has this been, as somebody who follows this stuff so closely, has this been shocking
to you? I'm not surprised, but I'm also not innocent, because I supported the Iraq War at first.
Mm-hmm.
And I supported the Iraq War because, like a lot of people on both sides of the aisles, and in Europe, Australia, and the United States, I assumed that there were weapons of mass destruction. But more deeply, I was a journalist who got too close to my story. I reported from Saddam's Iraq on a number of occasions in the 1980s and was so horrified by the regime there. I compared it only to the Ceausescu regime in Romania.
Really?
It was much worse than the regime in Syria. I have a big argument with people who put Saddam and the Assads together. No, Saddam was much worse. And therefore, the combination of being too emotionally close to my story as a reporter and 9/11 and believing the WMD made me an initial supporter of the Iraq War. I now realize that that was a mistake for larger reasons. Reasons that have to do with you don't get involved on the ground anywhere unless there is an overwhelming and immediate national security interest.
Weren't the American people as a whole too close to the story, emotionally speaking, after 9/11?
Well, I think the public gets too close to every story nowadays. We go from one sensational half-life to another. Mm-hmm. I look at the shooting down of the Malaysian airliner. For that was the 96-hour wonder. We all thought that that was going to end Putin's domination. He would be so humiliated. Well, it turns out it had no effect whatsoever. If you look at the news of the past 2 weeks.
I really appreciate you kind of saying that you changed your mind and it's been a lesson learned. Do you think that is the case for most geopolitical thinkers? Do you think, for example, the neocons, quote unquote, have changed their minds? Has this been eye-opening for someone like George Bush, for Dick Cheney?
I mean, I think the President Bush has acted with dignity since he left office. He said nothing. You know, mm-hmm. He doesn't contradict President Obama. He's not a pole of media attention, and he hasn't made himself one. He's deliberately stayed hidden, which I think is the appropriate role for any former president. We can only have one president at a time. I think all people involved in policy who take opinions on policy, all people are wrong some of the time. And the question, you know, failure is something we all live with. The question is, can we use it to make us better persons, you know, or better analysts in the future? From listening to former Vice President Cheney and some others, I don't get the feeling that they've learned anything. Maybe they have, but right. I don't hear it.
Right. I want to go back
for
a second.
I would say also, I mean, really importantly, because I think, you know, the execution of the reporter is a really good example of us getting too close to the story. You know, one person dies, but it affects the psychology of hundreds of millions, which is exactly what terrorists want. They want to create terror
right.
in your mind.
Policy, foreign policy. It is not, is only harder and more prone to mistakes if the administration gets emotionally wound up in such an incident. Because this was partly the mistake, I believe, of the Bush administration's when it was outlining on paper its like enhanced interrogation procedures. Keep in mind that those procedures were delineated in the weeks and months following 9/11 when the public was baying for blood. They didn't think that these procedures might look very differently a year or two from now.
Mm-hmm. And that is, I think that for me, so much of the failure of our response to 9/11 is about the public's response. Like, even if our leaders learn, the public also has to learn. We really have to come to terms with the fact that terrorism is theater. It is designed to make us emotional, and it is designed to make us react emotionally and do stupid things. And so, therefore, we have to distance ourselves from specific events and understand what are the broad patterns.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
And we have a narrative, and I fall victim to it. Here I am asking you, who are the bad guys in this? I want answers. I want the bad guys. And of course, you know, one of the things that I do appreciate about someone like Paul Wolfowitz or Pearl is that, look, I mean, and as you know, Saddam Hussein was, I hope there's a special place in hell for the guy, because his hero was Joseph Stalin. So, you know, there's bad and then there's Saddam Hussein, right? I mean, this guy is...
Yeah, Saddam Hussein was not a dictator. He was a suffocating totalitarian who was somewhere south of Joseph Stalin, but north of Bashar al-Assad.
Wow.
Is the way that I would categorize him.
Is there anywhere online a spectrum of assholes where we can just see
yeah, exactly.
where everybody lies?
Exactly. So here's a question, and it's a broader question. As a global thinker, as somebody who comes, you know, who probably has some influence here in foreign policy, when you have somebody who is this egregious when it comes to human rights, somebody who has miscalculated three times, you know, and started three different wars, when does the United States have a responsibility to act, and what do you think that should entail? If not boots on the ground, obviously.
As I said, the first thing you do is you try to the extent that you can to leverage your allies to get them to do as much work as possible. Mm-hmm. Secondly, you have special operations forces who train and equip local armed forces. It doesn't always work right. fine. You can't build an army from scratch and make it functional in 3 years like we tried to do with the Iraqi army. But there's a lot that they can do teaming up with host country forces that they succeed with all around the world all the time that never gets into headlines. You have air power. You have sea power, and sea power applies to the deserts of the Middle East because aircraft carrier submarines and guided missile destroyers can fire weaponry from hundreds of miles away. So you have various tools that can be implied. You also have to build up and constantly improve your intelligence agencies. You have to, you know, use your snooping, your electronic snooping capacities to, you know, everything you can possibly do to avoid immersing yourself on the ground in a way that you risk a quagmire.
It sounds like you just gave us a blueprint for how to deal with ISIS.
Also, it has to be long-term. We can't just do nothing and then have this debate about military intervention. We have to have, like, a constant involvement, but not at the highest level.
And to some extent, that's also what news encourages us to do, that 24-hour news cycle. We're like, oh, my God, there's a fire over here. Oh, my God, there's a fire over here.
Exactly.
And so we're running between.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a matter of patient application over years and even decades.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And the other thing that you mentioned in the context of the Soviet Union, and we had the coiner of this term on recently, soft power, you know, the ability to, you know, wage ideological and cultural warfare as well.
Yeah, that's very important. Now, you're referring to Harvard professor Joseph Nye.
Yes.
And where he says that soft power is the power to persuade. And that's, you know, and that again is part of the arsenal, particularly in the parts of the Muslim world who, you know, that are functional. We, you know, there are some evolving regimes in the Muslim world that are not democratic but are what I call liberal autocracies. Mm-hmm. Morocco, Oman, Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps Algeria, if it can get through this succession crisis, because its president is dying, it appears. So it's not like there is nothing where we cannot. It's not like there's nothing to work with. There is. Turkey has a democratic society. It's a bit too Islamic for Western taste. But that's to be expected. Turkey being an Islamic country is going to be a neutral power between the Islamic world and the West. It's not going to be wholly Western anymore.
Mm.
But yet it's a powerful regional player, which we should do as much with as we possibly can.
Why, and you may not have the answer to this, but why, and I've read this, that our intelligence agency pre-9/11 had very few Arabic speakers and very few people in the agency that really understood Arabic history.
You have to understand, our intelligence apparatus historically was built to fight communism.
Soviets, yeah.
Yeah, it was, and remember, the Cold War went on for 44 years, from 1945 to 89. That's a long time.
And Rumsfeld
was a generation and a half.
Right.
So that the whole way of doing things was how to snoop on the Soviet Union, essentially, how to count their missile heads. Change is hard in entrenched bureaucracies.
Yeah, I guess so.
Well,
that makes a lot of sense.
And I think this is so important to come back to the American people. Like, the American people have to develop a sustained attention and a willingness to watch everything rather than just being like, the Soviets are it. Let's not pay attention to the rest of the world. Let's cut the budget. Let's do all these things.
That's what they should be. I don't see them ever becoming like that because it's the nature of publics, of mass publics in a media age. To have short attention spans, 90% of their energy is devoted to the challenges and anxieties of their own daily lives.
So
their focus on the world is intermittent and episodic.
But by being episodic, it ultimately ends up being much more expensive because...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it does. I mean, look, ultimately, foreign policy is the extension of our domestic condition.
Mm-hmm.
And our domestic condition, because we're a continent that between two oceans, 3,000 miles across, with so many problems inside of it between those two oceans, that the ability of people to focus beyond is problematic.
Indeed, until they realize that it actually affects things at home and directly themselves directly.
Yes.
But it hasn't so far. Is there a silver lining in the rise of ISIS in terms of how it's bringing the United States and Iran together?
Yeah, it could be. It could be. Because remember, the United States and Iran share strategic interests of some sort. They both want to contain and defeat Sunni terrorism, even though Iran had played a little bit with Sunni terrorism in the Iraq war to get us out of Iraq. But essentially, we're on the same side that way. We want to see a balance of power in the Middle East between between Sunnis and Shias. Iran is a much more westernized place than Saudi Arabia. Women can ride motorcycles, wear makeup. The Tehran skyline has churches. You won't find that in Riyadh. Historically, Iran should have some sort of a status quo arrangement with the United States. The estrangement between Iran and the United States has now gone on much longer than that between the United States and Red China prior to Nixon's visit.
Right.
So it's ripe for settling. But one of the challenges is, whereas Nixon and Kissinger only had to deal with two Chinese, Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai, the Tehran governing hierarchy is not that concentrated in two people. It's different factions, different power centers, one trying to undermine the other. So it's much more difficult to get a real pivotal change of policy there.
And that also applies. I mean, one of the big mistakes that the Shah made was to think that Tehran was Iran, right? In the sense that there's such a big difference between the capital and the hinterlands.
Exactly. Yeah, that's true. But I think most Iranians. This was my experience traveling through Iran and also traveling through Egypt and other parts of the Arab world, is that if you were a person from Mars and just landed at any of these places with no context whatsoever, you would think from the way average people talk that the average Iranian that Iran was a country with good relations with the United States. And Egypt was a country with bad relations because the average Iranian was pro-American.
Wow, and they're all younger. I mean, I can't remember what the average, the mean age is, but so many are under the age of 30. They always talk about this sort of velvet revolution that seems to be going on within Iran. They want the things that their Western counterparts have.
Yeah, Iran is a young society ripe for change that is being held back by the fact that its regime is simply not trusted around the world, that limits foreign investment, limits the growth of jobs, limits the strength of the currency. Nothing would be welcome more among the Iranian people than a rapprochement with the United States.
And I think that's also, in terms of the American public, that's one of the big mistakes, is that we just sort of think of the Middle East. And I had an Arab friend who described Iran as the Brazil of the Middle East. You know, different language, different culture, and much hotter women.
I put it this way. Had the Shah not been toppled, again, a big if, Iran would have evolved like South Korea did under Chung-hee Park.
Wow.
It would have evolved from a dictatorship to a messy, imperfect constitutional democracy that had significant tensions with the United States, but was ultimately behind the scenes an American ally.
Is that still possible?
Yes, I think it is.
Great.
Excellent.
Well, we don't want to take any more of your time up, Robert Kaplan. Thank you so much. Your writings and your thinking are needed out there. And I really appreciate not only you coming on the podcast, but also, you know, just talking about how your mind was changed by Iraq. That's a rare thing indeed.
And that's a remarkable level of intellectual integrity to be able
to
admit that.
Well, thank you so much for that.
You're a good man, sir. Keep doing what you're doing. We need you out there.
Okay,
and
bye.
You're welcome back anytime. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Robert Kaplan, ladies and gentlemen, author of The Revenge of Geography, What the Map Tells Us About Coming Conflicts, and about 20 other books. It's unbelievable, man.
Yeah, well,
I'm going to write 20 books.
Well, Brian, you know, the first one is a good place to start.
Yeah, I should just read, I know.
No, you should write 20 books.
I think so. What would I write about? Let's see. Well, today I went to the store.
No, Brian, that's the point. I mean, what we need is we need people to read all these books and then make them funny and accessible.
Yeah, I have to say, Hunter and I are trying to develop this TV show, and Hunter's been writing sort of the general credo around it, and it's been a learning experience. Trying to come up with accurate simplicity, you know, is really something I really loved. And by the way, I want to end every podcast that Hunter coined this phrase, and I want to end every podcast with, and I didn't because I forgot, but we do this podcast because some of the best ideas are stuck in books. And I think that's my frustration, is that I meet so many people who are frustrated with the way the world works. I read a book. I don't know. I can't. You got to be careful. I was on Joe Rogan's podcast. I was like, you know, there's another book I wanted to say. Yeah. And Rogan was like, dude, with the books already. I mean, stop it. I don't want to hear you talk about all the books you've read and regurgitating this stuff. And he was right. I mean, but you don't want to be regurgitating these ideas. And one of the things that happens when you start reading a lot of books is you go from point of view to point of view. And what we're trying to do here in this podcast, and certainly with this TV show and Hunter and I talk about, is to come up with what are the big ideas?
Well, and what are the ideas that survive going from big idea to big idea? Because that's the point, is that, you know, that if you read a little, then it's like, oh my God, I just read this book, which is amazing, right? I read this book, which is amazing. And every new idea seems like a brilliant perspective.
Or if you talk to two very smart people, we had Paul Wolfowitz on, he would have said, well, things would be different if I was in charge.
Yeah.
And he'd actually probably, because he's a smart guy and he's an academic guy, and he'd make a very strong, I'm sure, intellectual argument
the issue
for
in such
why
a way.
Iraq is
That's
still
right.
going well or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then and so what happens is, if you're not a sophisticated geopoliticist or whatever it is.
No, if you haven't read enough books, you don't have to be
you'll bounce back and forth.
Yeah.
And so what we want to do is try to come up with the root, not only the root cause of the problem, but then a solution.
Yeah, and essentially a worldview, so that, you know, you have like the mental infrastructure to be able to sort through what anybody is saying. So it's like, oh, you're making this health claim. Okay, let me have a way to sort through that and see if that's actually valid, right? You're making this claim about foreign policy. Let me have, and you know, one of the things that I think is really interesting that is often lost is the founding fathers did not trust political philosophy.
They didn't.
They didn't particularly trust it because it's so easy to come up with an abstraction
of
what the world should be or anything like that. The thing that they trusted most was history, because history is, you know, the experiment of human society.
I was going to say that.
It's the laboratory.
I've taken enough political philosophy classes, including one online on YouTube. There's one that's taught at Yale. And I was no closer to the truth. I do. I think that history is a very, very valuable tool.
Yeah.
Alexander the Great knew that when you went into a country and you wanted to take it over, you didn't uproot everything that had been there. You worked with the infrastructure that was available to you, and you made demands, but reasonable ones, on that population. If you want to go in and change a country for the better, quote unquote, first of all, you better step back and say, I can't. And then if you really have to try, make sure you are very familiar with its infrastructure, its history, everything else.
You can change a country for the better, because people have. Like, otherwise the world would not have evolved. But the trick is to draw on people's own history rather than say...
Isn't it also about ideas?
It is about ideas. But essentially what I think one of the mistakes that we've made, and, you know, from, again, one of the great books, The Diffusion of Innovations, what we try and do is we try and say, these are our ideas. You must adopt our ideas. And then it becomes instantly like human beings react to that. And you're like, you know, fuck your culture, my culture, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And what you have to do is, I think in general, you have to dig into people's own history and find whatever principle it is that you're looking at. So, for example, right, in the Muslim world, right, there is currently not a culture of dissent. And so as when we talked to Tamim Ansari, he's like, you have to look back at Muslim history and their history as they understand we were on a path to take over the world and then our destiny was disrupted.
Right.
Well, what you have to
say. Thank you, Genghis Khan.
Well, I mean, you know, there were internal factors too. Yeah. But so then you have to say, you know, that what the Muslims are, a lot of what they're trying to figure out is why did our destiny get disrupted, right? And so the sort of the simple explanation that people like Osama bin Laden are trying to propose is, oh, because we deviated from the pure Islam. Like, yeah, that's what went wrong. As opposed to, the reason why you went wrong is because the culture of dissent and questioning that you had at the beginning, right, and of open conversation was shut down, right? There was the closing of the gates. And so if you want a culture of dissent in the Muslim world, rather than saying you need to be more like Americans, I think you need to say you need to be more like your own past.
My feeling is whenever I look at ISIS or even Hamas and stuff is that, you know, I don't consider them this sort of imminent threat to the United States. What I think is that they're so extreme, and Hamas is a little bit different, but ISIS, for example, is so extreme, it'll be a snake eating its own tail. What I worry about is a failed state, Iran becomes Somalia. I mean, Iraq becomes Somalia or Afghanistan. And then I, of course, worry about all the innocent, the women and children and men, for that matter, who, you know, then have nothing but sorrow and just a pile of ash and stone.
But that's the thing. Even the way that you're talking about the surrounding population is to think of them as helpless. Right. And I think that's fundamentally the problem.
Well, I don't think they're helpless. But if you look at Liberia, if you look at Sierra Leone,
if you look at
these war-torn countries, they really do. The victims, you know, when we talk about reconciliation and things, people forget about the victims. It's very difficult to come back from that kind of insanity.
But the problem is that I think for a lot of it is, you know, because my parents spent a while in Libya and, you know, they were there during the revolution or right up until the revolution. And then, you know, they've been back since. But I think a large part of the problem is that, you know, it's funnily enough, it's a lot like Hobbes's Leviathan, right? Because, you know, Hobbes understood, right, that the worst thing is anarchy, mm-hmm. right? The war of all against all, mm-hmm. right? And so he was like, you took away the dictator, and now we have anarchy,
yeah.
right? So it's much better to have a new dictator who's going to make sure that we're not just all killing each other,
right?
Right. The problem is that most people don't have in place the ability to understand or articulate how you solve the problem of the dictator.
The aftermath,
yeah. Or how do you, you know, you need the understanding so that you can refute those arguments and so that you can fight for rule of law. Like, that's what's missing in Libya.
Which goes back to studying history. What made the United States and certainly what made Britain so successful is their strength of their institutions.
Yeah, I think that's the problem is that again, like, we've come out of a period of history which is all about experts, and that the experts are going to sit there and solve these problems, but the societies are made up of people, yeah. and the people need to understand and have the intellectual infrastructure to be able to respond to these things. Otherwise, what's going to happen is it's going to be very easy for them to be swayed. They're not going to know how to respond. And essentially, in Libya, it's a country of 7 million people. When my parents were there, the estimate was that there were 7,000 fundamentalists. Like, 7,000 nut jobs can hold a country of 7 million people hostage.
Of course.
That's because I think the 7 million don't know what the alternative is. They can't really articulate it and all that sort of stuff.
Or they just are trying to go through their lives and get their kids ready for school, etc.
If you don't, that's the point, is that's not a workable strategy. Because ultimately, you know, your ability to have the life that you want for you and for your kids is going to be derailed by the 7,000 nut jobs. You have to deal with the 7,000 nut jobs, right, in some way and contain their force. And those mechanisms of control don't, it's not just institutions in terms of governments, it's also moms.
Right.
Like, moms have an incredible ability to police the actions of their sons and,
it's
like,
true.
Slap them with a handbag, be like, you're an
or
idiot.
An umbrella.
Or an umbrella. You're not going out tonight. You're not hanging out with those losers. You're going to study. You're going to do this, whatever, whatever, whatever. But there, I think that's the thing. I think there's so often that we're trying to solve these problems without the people.
Right.
That's a good point. You know, I mean, yeah. I think that's the thing. It's we need to stop thinking of the people as helpless. They just don't know how to help themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, learned helplessness.
Yeah.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, once again, because some of the best ideas are stuck in books. This has been Brian Callen. and Hunter Motz.
And Robert D. Kaplan.
And, Robert D.
Rena
Kaplan.
Marie.
And Rena Marie. Good and night and good luck.
That's strangely scary. Yes. Like, you're on your own.
I certainly am. I just like speaking this way. And I think, full disclosure, I'm looking at hot tennis players. I just Googled hot tennis players.
Oh, my
players.
God. Who'd you find, Brian?
I'm just looking at a bunch of pictures. I'm obsessed with tennis. And then I was like, I'm bored, and I'm going to look at hot tennis players.
Well, let me ask you this, Brian. Yeah. Which was, did I bore you?
My body's better than Djokovic's, by the way. What's that?
Did I bore you? Or
no,
did...
you never bore me. Oh, in fact, okay. You teach me a lot.
Wait, so who's Djokovic?
Well, he's the best tennis player.
Oh, so you're looking at hot male tennis players.
I am. I'm a straight man, but I like to see what my competition is.
Oh, and, Brian.
In fact, my buddy Brennan said if there was he was talking about if there was celebrity dick pics and celebrity naked women, what would you go to first? I'd have to go to the celebrity dick pics to see how I was doing in comp. We like to go from talking about lofty things to dick pics, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
Once again, thank you.
Let's hope that Robert D. Kaplan doesn't listen to this episode.
Either way, he was great.
He was amazing, as long as he stops after he stops talking.
And he was so good at talking in clips where you could, you know, he would speak in a clip and then he'd give us, he's just kind of an orderly brain, unlike myself.
Well, but that's the point. I think we're all in the process of ordering our own brains.
Yeah.
Which is the real thing. It's structure, clarity.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Which is hopefully what this show provides.
I hope you can hear that clicking because I just keep going from picture to picture. All right.
Still on male tennis players, Brian,
No,
right?
It's actually female right now.
Oh.
But I did Google male. I haven't gotten the male tennis players yet. All right. There's the images. Yeah. There they are. Oh, there they are. I don't have the hair. I hate these guys.
We know what the geopolitical threats are to our country,
yeah.
But what are the threats to your ego?
Anybody with thick, dark hair and who's younger than I am. It reminds me of my own mortality.
But funnily enough, that's the thing. Attractive women aren't threatening to your ego, right? It's really just like attractive,
it's
handsome.
The competition.
It's the competition, the, yeah.
Even though I'm married.
Brian, let's imagine this. How would you feel? I mean, you know, forget being king of the world for the day and having political power,
sure.
Right? Imagine if you had erotic power. Right?
Oh, well, yeah.
Like total erotic power.
I never leave the house. I mean, that's all I've ever heard. What do you think this podcast is about? I'm trying to impress hot, brainy chicks.
Yeah.
Anyway. Well, Hunter, your hair is getting very long.
Yeah, it's time for a haircut.
Yeah, we got to bring it down a little bit.
Yeah, I've turned down the volume.
You're
it's
a
at 11
guy.
Right now.
We know you have a big brain, but when the hair's that big, it just looks like your brain's even bigger.
I have a talk on Monday, so I'm going to cut it before then.
You do, huh?
Yeah.
By the way, Hunter's book, The Straight Edge Conspiracy, stands the test of time, and I think everybody should read it. I don't think you should be just a high school student. I think it's an excellent book, so make sure you get that, and we will endeavor to keep this thing going. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.